It's Curtain Call. I'm Charles Sipos. In today's program, I chat first with music director Bruno Ferrandis. We talk about Santa Rosa Symphony's performance of Mahler's Monumental Symphony No. 3, Saturday evening, Sunday afternoon, and Monday evening at Weill Hall, as well as the 2015-2016 season of the Santa Rosa Symphony. Next, pianist Jeffrey Cahane talks about his Friday evening recital at Weill Hall, followed by his preview of Chamberfest 2015, June 24th through 28th at Green Music Center. All this comes up next in today's Curtain Call. Bruno Ferrandis, welcome to Curtain Call.
Thank you very much, Charles, for having me.
Always great to have you on, and we're talking about the current concert of the Santa Rosa Symphony at Weill Hall, which began last night and continues today in an afternoon concert and tomorrow in an evening concert, and also about the Santa Rosa Symphony's 2015-2016 season. So let's start out with concert. Always exciting to talk about music that you're currently doing. So what is on the concert in this series?
We are speaking of Mahler, the Third Symphony, which is, by the way, the longest Mahler symphony. I didn't choose the I chose not the easy way. It is called the Wunderhorn Symphony, because it's in the Wunderhorn cycle of poems of Brentano and Arnim von Meyren, the poet Brentano. And it belongs to the same as the second, the Resurrection, the third, hence the third, which has no, it's very strange, the third has no nickname, has no secondary name, and the fourth. All the fourth symphony, number one, two, but less number one, because it has no words, but two, three, and four belonging to the same series of spirit and of way of composition by Mahler. The text is very important, and so it's a very literate symphony, that first symphony. It's very hard for a musician to command that symphony.
So let's talk about this kind of symphony, which really did not exist before Beethoven's Ninth, to my knowledge. And then in Beethoven's Ninth, he, of course, made the final movement for soloists and chorus very much like an oratorio or a passion, that kind of music that had been around for a long time, but it hadn't been part of the symphony. And then here, Mahler continues this, as I believe did Mendelssohn and others, with incorporating music for voice, whether that's for soloists or for chorus, or for both.
Yes, it's very interesting that every movement it has. This is the symphony that has the particularity of having six movements, and every movement has a sort of undertitle, a sort of an underneath meaning. So the first, the awakening of Pan, the god Pan. You know, for the Greeks, Pan was the god of nature. The god, he was the impersonation of a man, but a man of the nature. And Pan in Greek, by meaning, strictful meaning, means everything. Pan is everything in Greek, all, the whole thing. So
like Pan-American.
Like Pan-American, exactly. And so Mahler goes to from the first movement to Pan and the Awakening and the Summer. Let's remember that Mahler was in the mountain, the Austrian mountain, when he composed that first symphony. So that helps to imagine why, you know, he was taken by this subject. And then the second movement, what the flowers in the prairie tell me. And the third movement, what the animals in the forest tell me. And the fourth movement is the famous O Mensch from the Zarathustra by the Nietzsche text, which is the impersonation of mankind. O Mensch, gib acht. Watch out, man. Watch out, gib acht. You know, it doesn't come very long to, you know, to hear a warning already from the man and its nature. Then the fifth movement, the one with the Knaben core, the core for young, the chorus for young children and the women, is the movement for the angels. And finally, Mahler, in the sixth movement, come up the upper level. It's like a Masonic mass or Masonic ritual for me. The sixth movement is about love. So from the coarse nature to love, with six different stages. So
very, very beautiful. And you really get that in the music. The music, the music is so beautiful just by itself. Even if you don't understand the words, even if you don't understand the language that the words are sung in, it's so gorgeous just by itself and so meaningful. And then when you assign a meaning, like this meaning, which happens to be his meaning, or even creating your own meaning, there's so much to be present to in this music.
Yes, absolutely. The thematic, the motive, the motivic strength of Mahler is there present. You know, when you hear this yum, pa 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 pam, ta ta ta, ta ta ta, and you hear these woodwinds go ta di di with a big crescendo. You know, it really takes your soul away. I mean, the goosebumps come, and then comes this unheard trombone, which is supposed to evoke Pan, the god Pan, who wakes up. You know, he's probably yearning. Bom, ba, 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 pira. You know, the superhuman in all its crudity, in all its rawness, all these words, you know? And then when you come to, let's say, the fifth movement, when you hear bim, bam, you hear really the glocks, the bells of the angel. It's amazing how the motives and the themes stick to, you know, you cannot escape thinking, this is it, I see that, you know, or, you know, I think the movement that I prefer of all is the O Mensch, because the O Mensch is so calm, is so quiet. Man is seen as somebody very peaceful, as very in the darkness, basses, cello at the beginning. It's amazing. I mean, the strength of Mahler is the strength of his motive, is his strength, the strength of his poetry, his imagery. You know, it's like you see images as at once when you hear his music, when you hear his themes. It's so impressive. And of course, you know, the modernity of his orchestration, the constant invention, the constant development of ideas. For instance, the idea in the third movement, the one which relates to the animals in the forest, of putting this posthorn far away, a trumpet, a posthorn, very far away, so that you hear something going from nowhere and you don't understand where you are. So Mahler is already thinking in three dimensions, not only in two dimensions. He's already in the future of music, you know, like later, much later on, Stockhausen or, you know, Boulez would do things like that, the Gruppen and the In Memoriam Moderna, pieces like that, Ritual in Memoriam Moderna. It's the same idea already, as this idea of distance with the music, taking people by surprise. You know, it's amazing. The invention is, it's like a torrent of constant bullion of invention coming at you constantly, and you get, when you conduct that piece, it's amazing what you get under your skin. It's incredible, the power of that music.
It must be amazing to be on the podium for that. And a minute ago you said it takes your breath away, and I'm sure it literally does. Actually, you said it takes your soul away, but I think the way it does that is it takes your breath away. And being on the podium must be so powerful, because even in the hall, even being halfway back in the hall, the dynamic range of this music is huge. In other words, the range of expression is huge. And that's maybe what Mahler did for us among all composers more than any other, is to expand this expression of the orchestra. And often with very simple means, sometimes with children's songs, and they go from the most innocent, simple, delicate, to the most powerful, moving music with the whole orchestra just swelling.
My score, actually, which is the universal version, the Urtext version of that score, has plenty. I mean, there's a literal German dictionary of a glossary of German terms, and in the third movement, for instance, there's a famous passage for the cor anglais, English horn, and the oboe, where they have to, as Mahler says, wie ein Naturlaut, like a nature shout, nature, and the oboe is, and the cor anglais are asked to do power, so they have to do actually a glissando, a portamento with a reed. You know what it takes to do a reed portamento? It's not like a string where you can gliss with your fingers. You have to do it your mouth, your lips. And it's amazing, though. When you get the result, it's really, you hear a special bird from the marshlands, or one of those aquatic birds. It's amazing, the imagination. In the strings, in the third movement, you have constant changes. Col legno. With the bow beating the string,
with the wood,
with mutes, con sordino, put the mute away, restore the mute, col legno, ansteg, that means on the ponticello, on the bridge. It changes always. The color is constantly changing. It's why sometimes you have the impression you are in a movie. You see in the movie of a stream going down. And it changes colors. It has reflections, and we change its color all the time. And that's the power of the music.
So what you're saying is, if I can translate this into non-musical terminology, the strings, for example, are constantly changing the mode in which they're playing. And it's indicated by the composer, by Mahler, in the score, in their parts. And they are expected to change moment by moment by moment by moment. And there are so many changes. He's so specific. And what he is after is specific. And what he gets is specific. And you can hear that from interpretation to interpretation. There might be a slight difference in tempo or intensity or whatever. But Mahler's intention stands. And it's because he was so specific in his scores.
He was not only specific, he was almost authoritarian, because I've never seen so many notes to the conductor, Anmerkung zu Dirigent, it says, you know, notes to the conductor, please beat this passage in 4, please beat this passage in 2, you know, giving you notes about the way to do a passage, giving you, for instance, at the end, I think it's the end of the third movement, da-di-di-da-di-di-da-da-da-da, he says, please stay firmly in tempo without any rallentando. He's extremely knowledgeable about what he wants, and he's extremely specific to the point of, it's unheard of. I mean, it's all the contrary of a classical composer like Beethoven or Mozart, where you have a mere tempo, and then you go off, and you have to invent the music as you go. Mahler, it's specificity itself, bar per bar. It's incredible.
Let's remember that Mahler was a conductor, and in fact, he was the music director of the New York Philharmonic for a time.
Yes, and the Wiener Staatsoper also. So he had the strongest conductor's experience and pragmatism. He knew, by putting these innumerable in the score, in my Mahler 3 score, Nicht Eilen, he knew that the orchestra would run at a certain passage, and you know, he would anticipate that by putting Nicht Eilen, you know. So you know that with him, you are guided through. It's amazing. It's a permanent guide, Mahler.
More Mahler to come. You can hear the Mahler Third Symphony in concerts this afternoon and tomorrow evening at Weill Hall. It's the Santa Rosa Symphony under the baton of Bruno Ferrandis, who is my guest on Curtain Call this segment. Well, Bruno, we have some time now to talk about the new season of the Santa Rosa Symphony, and it's the 2015-2016 season. Maybe the best thing to do is start with highlights, and then as we have time, we can fill in.
Well, in my memory, there's no season that I've done with series of pieces as this series. I mean, if I think of the beginning, opening concert, Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony number 3, to Brahms first, to Beethoven 9th, culminating to Beethoven 9th in December, to Dvorak number 8 by the guest conductor Chinese American May I Chen. Bruckner 9th, it's the first time I'm going to conduct Bruckner 9th, which is another great, incredible piece of music. And lots of ballet idea. It's the first time I think they will hear the Three-Cornered Hat by Defaya. It's a music that I love because I conducted as a young conductor with the ballet, with the dancers, from the pit, not on the podium. So it's going to be very interesting for our audience. And finally, to finish the Spanish Impressionist French Debussy Iberia and Ravel Rhapsody Espanol, so Spanish Rhapsody. So it's incredible the season that we have just in sheer masterworks.
I love when you conduct ballet because I know you are such an experienced conductor of ballet. You've spent many, many hours on the podium conducting ballet, and it's a different animal when you're conducting actually for the dancers. So talk about that just a little bit.
Well, you know, the dancers have a very funny, no insult to them. I love dancers. I think they are the most unbelievable artist race on the earth because they are the most disciplined people. But they have a very strange way to count. For instance, you have a 7-4 bar and they will count 1 and 2 and 3 and. So for them, that's 7 because it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 for the and. So when you get out of that problem, you have to be, what is great for the schooling of conducting ballet is that you have to be extremely flexible to their body. You have to accompany their body, not their voice, but their muscles. You have to accompany their muscles. You have to see the length of time they are going to be suspending in the air with that pas de deux, or you know, jump, high jump, and then go down. And then the point they go down, you go down with your beat. And it's an incredible school for a conductor because you really learn how to observe. And dancers have an innate sense of rhythm that we don't have because they are closer to their body. So you end up, when you do a Rite of Spring with them or the Three-Cornered Hat that I'm going to do this season, you end up with a very different type of interpretation. Sometimes it takes more time because the body is heavier to lift than, you know, than an instrument and than a tempo. You know, with a tempo, you accelerate. But with a body, and especially with a group of bodies, you cannot accelerate the tempo like this. You have to go with the dancers little by little with their movements and accompany their movements. And that's all the difference. And that shapes the music in a very different way, I would say.
So how did you learn how to do that? Did you learn by experience? Were you just kind of thrown into ballet, or did you prepare for it in, you know, by studying?
No. I was asked at Juilliard. It's where I started ballet. At Juilliard, with the Juilliard Ballet Company, to accompany some ballet, some Copland music, some Stravinsky music, very difficult music. I mean, for a young conductor, I remember the Symphony in Three Movements, which is a very hard symphony, or some Copland, or some reinterpretation, rearranged music from Handel, Waterworks, Fireworks, and all of that. And that is very hard for us when you are not experienced. But the hardest is the best for a youngster, because it's there that you learn how to accommodate. It's incredible. You have to be extreme. You have to be at the same time extremely knowledgeable about your score and extremely flexible with the human material, so to speak. So it's a great. It's a great school.
Were you surprised the first time you were actually conducting with dancers?
Yes, because dancers don't relate to the music we do. They don't know what the notes are. They don't know do, si bemol, la, sol. So when you speak to them, do you mean on the B flat or do you mean on the C? Say, no, it's when it goes ta, ta, ta. Or, you know, it's very hard for them. They cannot sing the music, actually. They hum it. They will give you a vague idea. And you have to have this sort of common sense to get back to where they are with their brains and where they are with their bodies, because in fact their body is even more important than their brains in actual dancing, in actual ballet performance.
I'm speaking with Bruno Ferrandis, who is music director of Santa Rosa Symphony, and now let's get back to the season. So we've spoken about the highlights. Now let's speak in some detail about perhaps some of the concerts in the next 5 or so minutes that we have.
Well, we have great concertos. We have the two lovely Norton sisters who are going to play Mozart and Poulenc double piano concertos, which is incredible. I have a great Sarajevo-born pianist, Peja Mujicevic, who is going to play both Schumann piano concerto, which is a piece that I love above all, and bring a Kurtág piece, Györgyi Kurtág, which is called Quasi una Fantasia, which is totally taken from Schumann. It's like the fantasy Stück by Schumann. So he's going to play two pieces for us. It's extraordinary. We are having the Tchaikovsky violin concerto with this wonderful Caroline Goulding. We are having the Beethoven concerto mixed with the Bruckner symphony with the famous Rachel Barton Pine. I'm really looking forward to be working with her. She's brilliant. We have the return of the great Zulbeidi. Herwig Zulbeidi performed with us the Elgar, and he will perform the very rarely performed, and now looking at the score, I know why, Britten Cello Concerto, you know, commissioned by Mislav Rostropovich. So I know, I know about that now. And of course, we'll finish with this very apparently incredible talent. I think she's Mexican born, Gabriela Martinez, will perform the concerto in F by Gershwin. But on top of all of this, we have the arrival, the coming, I was very interested in having him, of Mohamed Fayrouz, who is a Palestinian, from Palestinian origin, Palestinian-born parents. I think he is born in New York, but he's from Palestinian parents, who is going to premiere a piece for us called Pax Universalis. You know, the origin of that idea was that I was going to have him and maybe an Israeli composer, but we didn't do it for some mysterious reason that it was not possible to the composer was not available to gather the two. But that's the idea of peace. The idea of peace is tremendous. The organ symphony, which is also a piece which has talking about man and love and all of that. So it's a great thing. And we have also this great guy from New York, Daniel Brubaker, who is going to create a piece for us. He's a really well-known composer who has performed for the greatest orchestras in the world, for great singers, and I'm really glad to welcome him to Santa Rosa. So it's going to be a very exciting season.
Bruno Ferrandis, this sounds like a fantastic season. It's the 2015-2016 season of the Santa Rosa Symphony. Thanks for being my guest on Curtain Call.
It was really my pleasure, Charles.
Bruno Ferrandis conducts Mahler's Symphony No. 3 in Santa Rosa Symphony Concerts this afternoon and Monday evening at Weill Hall. For more information, go to santarosasymphony.com. I have a pair of tickets to the Monday evening performance of the Santa Rosa Symphony to give to caller number 5 to 584-2020. I'm Charles Sipos, and you're listening to Curtain Call. Let's listen next to Garrick Olson performing the aria from Bach's Goldberg Variations. Thank you. Jeffrey Kahane, welcome to Curtain Call.
Thank you, Charles. It's great to see you again.
So you're here today to talk about your recital at Weill Hall, actually your first recital there, though you've played there many times as a soloist. Here you are playing a solo recital there. Beethoven Opus 109 and the Bach Goldberg Variations, Bach and Beethoven. Why did you choose this program?
Well, I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to play the Goldberg Variations in Weill Hall. There's something about this hall. It has this amazing combination of spaciousness and intimacy, and of course the sound is gorgeous. And the Goldberg Variations is a piece that has been a central part of my repertoire now for almost 30 years. I actually played it in Santa Rosa quite a number of years ago at Santa Rosa High School as a special concert for the Santa Rosa Symphony. And I revisit this piece perhaps not every year, but certainly every other year at least. And it's one of those pieces that grows and changes with you as you grow and change with it. It's infinite and inexhaustible. And I thought it would also be wonderful. Very often I play the Goldberg Variations just by itself. It takes about an hour and 10 minutes altogether. but I wanted to also play the Beethoven Sonata Opus 109 as a kind of curtain raiser, I guess you could say, although albeit a very substantial one. It's going to be a kind of short first half to the program. The sonata takes about 20 minutes, a little less than 20 minutes. And it's a piece that is very deeply connected to the Goldberg Variations. The variations that constitute the last movement of the Beethoven Sonata are clearly inspired by and modeled on the Goldberg Variations. They're kind of, you might say, a miniature version they make very specific references to certain parts in the variations. They may have been unconscious on Beethoven's part, although frankly I doubt it because the similarities are just they're too obvious to be entirely coincidental. And we know that Bach was a profound influence on Beethoven, and that in his late sonatas he begins to turn more and more to thinking contrapuntally, thinking about the importance of the fugue. All of the great last five sonatas have either a set of variations or a fugue or both. And then, of course, after he wrote all of his piano sonatas, he wrote one more monumental masterpiece, the Diabelli Variations, which is, again, a very obvious tribute to the Goldberg Variations in part. And it's wonderful to see the ways that Beethoven is deeply inspired by Bach. He models things on Bach, and yet he's also saying, I'm doing something completely different.
Do you ever pair the Diabelli Variations and the Goldberg Variations?
I've done it once. I was invited by the Music at Menlo Festival a number of years ago, about, I think it was maybe 9 years ago now, to do a special day, because you really, it's an incredibly monumental thing to do. Either one of them on its own is huge. And we did a day in which I gave a little talk about the Goldberg Variations and played them at 11 in the morning, and then there was a lunch break, and then I came back and played the Diabelli Variations in the afternoon at 2 p.m. And it was something I was very glad I did. I'm glad I have done it, and I don't think I'll ever do it again.
It has to be so challenging to play two big monumental sets of variations like that in the same day.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the triathlon, you know. It's that kind of thing. You don't want to do it very often. But it was also, I think it was a profoundly enlightening experience for me, for the audience. It's just so moving to see the way these two masterpieces, the Goldberg Variations and the Diabelli Variations, reflect one another, and the relationship between Beethoven and Bach is a very special one. Beethoven, we know that he was exposed at a very young age to the well-tempered clavier. He played, as far as we know, he played all 48 preludes and fugues. And thanks to this remarkable figure named Baron von Swieten, who was also someone very important in the life of Mozart, Beethoven was exposed to the music of Bach at a time when it was already rather forgotten, as I think many people know. Bach was, by the end of his life, he was seen as kind of an archaic figure. His sons were much more popular and much better known than he was in terms of his music. He was a legend as an organist. And in the 1790s, 1780s and 1790s, a man named Baron von Swieten, who, by the way, if those in your listening audience who saw the movie Amadeus may remember this one character who plays a minor role. He's in the emperor's circle. He has a very long wig. And he's a real historical character who was incredibly important because he was in charge of this extraordinary collection of manuscripts, both of Bach and Handel, among others. And so he was instrumental in keeping the legacy of Bach alive and introducing both Mozart and Beethoven to some of the great masterpieces of Bach.
Just as a side, it was Mendelssohn who really resurrected Bach as a great figure in musical history, as he deserves to be. Was there any connection there between von Swieten and Mendelssohn, or through Beethoven, or anything? Did Mendelssohn happen to find the works of Bach on his own?
Mendelssohn would have been aware of the works of Bach from a very early age, through his own teachers, through the music of Beethoven, which of course was profoundly influential on him. You can see even in some of Mendelssohn's earliest works that he was deeply influenced by Beethoven and indeed by the late music of Beethoven. And so he would have been aware of Bach's music all along. And he was, of course, brought up as a Lutheran. So that was one place where Bach's music probably certainly survived in some ways in terms of the chorales. And you're right, it was in the 1830s that Mendelssohn gave the first performance in almost 100 years of the St. Matthew Passion. It was obviously a very modified version. They didn't do it complete. They made cuts and so on. But it was the beginning of the great Bach revival in the 19th century.
You said you revisit the Goldberg Variations every couple of years. And I'm wondering what you mean by that. Do you do that for yourself? Do you do that because you think it should be heard? Do you think it should be in your repertoire? Or is it a personal thing that you just feel that you should come back to the piece?
I think all of the above. The Goldberg Variations, 75 years ago, a performance of the Goldberg Variations was still something fairly unusual. 100 years ago, it was a performance of the Goldberg Variations would have been very rare. Only in the middle, I would say, of the 20th century did it begin to really re-enter the repertoire with, of course, players like Glenn Gould and Rosalind Turek, among others. And then, little by little, over the next decades, it became really a standard repertory piece. And I would say nowadays, I doubt that there's a month that goes by where the Goldberg Variations, anywhere in the world where the Goldberg Variations isn't being played somewhere by someone. It's no longer a rarity by any means. There are dozens of recordings, both on the harpsichord and on the piano. But having said all of that, it remains one of the towering achievements in terms of composition. It remains a very demanding work to perform. It's a great challenge, not just physically and mentally, but I would say spiritually and emotionally and psychologically. And for me, revisiting the piece constantly is a way of, first of all, my relationship to the piece deepens as I change, as I get older. I hope I'm a little bit more mature than I was the last time I played it, and I have more insight, different insights. It's just that kind of piece. I think this is also true, by the way, with the late works of Beethoven. I think that's why so many of us return to those pieces over and over and over again. They demand of us a kind of reflection, a kind of introspection, exploration, inner exploration, that very few other works in the repertoire do. And I think for me, the amazing thing about the Goldberg Variations, I could play them for the rest of my life every month, and I don't think I would ever get tired of them.
It sounds like you still to this day discover new things in the Goldberg Variations, even though you've been playing them for decades.
Absolutely. I don't even know quite how to describe that process, but that's the way, you know, I think we often lament in this day and age the use of the word classical with respect to music, because what does that really mean after all? What defines something being classical music? And I think the simplest way to address that is just by acknowledging the fact that a classic, by definition, is something that you can go back to over and over and over again and find new things in it. It is really perhaps more accurate to say sometimes that we find new things in ourselves in response to it, to a great work. It may be actually you notice a detail you never noticed before, or you see, you perceive some aspect of the piece in a way you never did before. But that's as much about changes in ourselves as it is anything else. I also think one of the things about the Goldberg Variations that is so special is it is one of those rare masterpieces that is not only profound, it's not only awe-inspiring, it's not only mind-boggling, it's also a great deal of fun. It has tremendous pathos, tremendous seriousness, and it has incredible humor. And it's very approachable in a way that not all of Bach is for, say, a new listener. It's a piece I think you can experience for the first time and just be touched and dazzled and moved. And you can experience it for the 100th time and be touched and dazzled and moved.
Theme and Variations is a compositional tour de force. And when you think of this piece that's filled with humor and joy and pathos, the extremes of human emotion, and think about it being derived from a simple song. That's where the compositional tour de force comes in, because the basis of the music is this simple little thing that you hear at the beginning and the end, as you usually do with a set of variations. And what comes in between is this enormous range of emotion of different characters.
You know, I want to just sort of make an adjustment to one thing you said, which is that you usually hear the theme at the beginning and the end. In fact, in most sets of variations, you don't hear the theme again at the end. You hear it at the beginning, and then you hear a series of transformations. That's one of the things that unites, by the way, the variations in the Beethoven Sonata that I'm playing and the Goldberg Variations, is that the theme does come back at the end, which makes it kind of like a journey where you start someplace and you go you go on a journey and then you come back to where you started. In most of the famous variation sets of the 18th and 19th century, you don't hear the theme at the end. And so these pieces are a little bit different in that way. But you're certainly right that it's a compositional tour de force in both cases, and in the case of the Goldberg Variations, particularly so, because you have this harmonic progression. It's really not a set of variations on a theme in this case. It's a set of variations on a bass line and a chord progression. Unlike, say, the variation sets by Mozart and the more popular sets of variations where it's really the melody that you hear transformed, this is all about the chord progression. It's all about the harmonies. And what that means is that you're not necessarily conscious all the time of what's going on in terms of the variations. I've had people say to me, "Well, I don't understand. You know, by the time I got to the 25th variation, I didn't hear anything like the theme." And that's actually perfectly fine. The theme isn't there, but the harmonic progression is always there in every one of the 30 variations. And what's remarkable is the extent to which Bach is able to stretch that to the absolute limit so that you're not actually necessarily aware of it. Although I think if you just allow yourself to feel it, you somehow know that it's always there in the background. If you're really determined to hear it and you want to listen to it over and over again, you will ultimately find that harmonic progression in every one of the variations, because it's there. In some variations, it's there very clearly. In some, it's more obscured by the complexity of what's going on. But this is, I think you pointed out quite correctly, that it all stems from something very simple. In this case, again, it's not a melody, but a bass line and a progression of chords that is indeed quite simple, and then becomes the basis for this unbelievably complex structure, which, in spite of its complexity, or perhaps it's better to say in addition to its complexity, is also very accessible, very human.
Jeffrey Kahane, thanks for being my guest on Curtain Call, and all the best in your recital.
Thanks so much, Charles.
Jeffrey Kahane gives his first recital in Weill Hall this Friday at 7:30. For more information, go to gmc.sonoma.edu. I have a pair of tickets to Jeffrey Kahane's May 8th recital to give to caller number 4 to 584-2020. I'm Charles Sipos, and you're listening to Curtain Call. Let's listen to Maurizio Pollini playing the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 30, Opus 109. Thank you. Jeffrey Kahane, welcome back to Curtain Call.
Thank you, Charles.
Our subject, this segment, is Chamberfest 2015 at Green Music Center. This is a very exciting little music festival that lasts from June 24th to 28th. I believe there are nine concerts in there. Nine concerts in just a few days, jam-packed with music by the three Bs, or maybe the five Bs, depending on how we look at it. First of all, give us the general programming idea you had about putting this together.
Well, as I think a lot of people recall in your audience, we had for several years a wonderful chamber music festival at Sonoma State before our beautiful Green Music Center and Weill Hall were built and in the process of their being built. And for a number of years now, I've hoped, it was always the intention at that time that the festival would ultimately move over to the new facility when it was finished. And I was thrilled when, in a conversation with Zarin Mehta, the executive director or co-executive director of the Green Music Center, I proposed reviving the festival, and he, without even a moment's hesitation, said, let's do it. And we sort of together came up with the idea of a festival devoted entirely to the three Bs, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, which might, on the surface of it, seem a little bit obvious and perhaps cliched. But in fact, what we're doing is something, I think, rather unusual, which is programming a great deal of music by Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, and a few other composers, in a way that I hope will shed really interesting light on the connections between these three composers, and particularly the way that Bach really serves so much as kind of the source from which Beethoven and Brahms drew so much inspiration.
Would it be productive to go through the program concert by concert and illuminate what you're talking about?
I'll try. It's a lot of music in, as you said, we're doing nine programs in 5 days.
What would there be a better way to do it? To talk about how you're achieving your goal here in this programming?
I think maybe what I could do is just give you some of the salient points, the high points of this, although all nine programs are going to be, I think, quite spectacular. And I want to start by saying that one of the things of which I am most proud about this is that I've pulled together an absolutely extraordinary collection of artists from all over the country, including members not only of my own orchestra, the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, but my former beloved orchestra, the Santa Rosa Symphony, principal players from the Los Angeles Philharmonic, members of the San Francisco Symphony, the San Diego Symphony, the California Symphony. It's going to be absolutely thrilling in terms of just the range of artists as well. We have some great soloists, Jennifer Koh, and Natasha Peremski, who's been made some spectacular appearances with the Santa Rosa Symphony, and the Miro String Quartet, one of the great string quartets in the world today. So what I've done essentially is put together programs, almost all of which have something by Bach, something by Beethoven, and something by Brahms. Not every single one. A few of them are only Beethoven. And then we're culminating the ninth, the final performance, which will be in Weill Hall, is going to be a performance of the complete Brandenburg Concertos, all six Brandenburg Concertos, played by the whole troupe together, pretty much all. I think there are 22 or 23 musicians. We're beginning, for example, the first program, we're going to begin with a beautiful arrangement by the great Hungarian contemporary master Kurtág of one of the Bach chorale preludes, which will be played by Natasha Peremski and me, then one of the Beethoven cello sonatas and the Brahms G minor piano quartet, one of his most dazzling and impassioned pieces. The second program is going to open with another one of these beautiful Kurtág Bach chorale preludes. I'll be joined by Jennifer Koh in one of the great violin sonatas of Beethoven, and then the beautiful trio for horn, violin, and piano of Brahms. Then on the third program, which will be in, some of these programs, by the way, are in the evening in Schroeder Hall. Some are in the afternoon, and we're actually going to try something really interesting and doing a program at 11 a.m. on one of the days. One of the programs, the third program, is going to be a conversation between the piano and the beautiful organ in Schroeder Hall of music of Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, which will feature Natasha Peremski playing one of the late sonatas of Beethoven, the sonata Opus 110, which includes two fugues very clearly influenced by Bach. She'll conclude with the variations and fugue by Brahms on a theme of Handel, again, another direct connection with the 18th century art of the fugue and Brahms. And then Natasha and the fabulous organist Charles Russ are going to have a kind of musical conversation with the piano and the organ, exchanging, talking together, you might say, with music by Bach on the organ, music of Brahms on the organ. Many people don't know that at the end of his life, Brahms wrote some magnificent, very moving chorale preludes, again inspired by Bach, for organ. And some of this will be actually interspersed with one another.
I have a question, a really essential question, and that is, the organ is tuned in unequal temperament, and I don't know if it's tuned to A440. So where are you going to find a piano or a piano technician who will adjust the piano to the organ tuning?
I believe that the organ will be tuned, is tuned at such a pitch that the piano can be played with it, or at least that there won't be a discrepancy that's really perceptible.
But there's always the question of temperament, because the B's are different, the F sharps are different.
Yes, but they're not actually going to be playing at the same time.
Ah, okay. So. You've eased my mind. I was really worried about that, because that can sound really terrible. Two instruments with different temperament or different pitch are played together.
They're not going to be playing at this simultaneously, but they will be playing in conversation with one another.
So. Okay, so yeah. In dialogue, back and forth.
Exactly.
Just right. As long as they don't speak at the same time.
Right. On another program, we have three incredible masterpieces, a Bach prelude and fugue from the Well-Tempered Clavier in the key of E minor, followed by the Brahms first cello sonata, which I'll be playing with my principal cellist from the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, Andrew Schulman. The last movement of this Brahms cello sonata, the E minor sonata, is a fugue, clearly inspired by the prelude and fugue that I'm going to play before it from the Well-Tempered Clavier. And then the Miro Quartet is going to play the great C major quartet from the Razumovsky Quartet, quartets of Beethoven, which ends with one of the most thrilling, dazzling fugues in the whole repertoire. On Saturday morning, the 27th of June, Jennifer Coe, who is one of the great young American violinists, is again going to join organist Charles Russ for a conversation, I guess you could say. She's going to open the program with one of the monumental unaccompanied sonatas of Bach, which again contains a great miraculous fugue for unaccompanied violin. And then Charles is going to play some music for organ by Bach and Buxtehude, who was...
Another B,
right. That same afternoon, the Miro Quartet is going to return to play the remaining two of the great Razumovsky quartets. And then in the evening, I will be opening with a Busoni transcription of one of the beautiful Bach chorale preludes. Also, a special treat on that program, which you may not have listed, is our beloved local treasure, Carol Menke, is going to join me for a pair of Brahms songs. I'm going to play the F major Brahms cello sonata with principal cellist of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Robert Demain. And that program is going to end with the wonderful septet of Beethoven, which was one of the most popular works of Beethoven's in his own time. Sunday afternoon, the final Sunday of the festival, Charles Russ is going to do a whole recital of what he calls the five B's, Buxtehude, Bruns, Böhm, Bach, and Brahms, and then the ninth program that evening in the big hall. In case this wasn't clear, by the way, the first eight programs are all in the beautifully intimate space of Schroeder Hall, but the ninth and final program with the complete Brandenburgs will be in Weill Hall.
And you'll be conducting from the keyboard?
I'll be leading from the harpsichord, yeah.
Jeffrey Kahane, this sounds like a spectacular concert series, and it is Chamberfest 2015. It runs from June 24th through 28th at Green Music Center, mostly in Schroeder Hall, and the final concert in Weill Hall. Thanks for being my guest.
It's my great pleasure, as always, Charles.
Chamberfest 2015 runs from June 24th through 28th at Green Music Center, culminating in a performance of all of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos in Weill Hall. Let's listen to Trevor Pinnock and the English Concert in the opening of Brandenburg Concerto No. 5. I'm Charles Sipos. Join us again next week for Curtain Call.